Chapter 16. I think I have to be the bad guy and put it out there that maybe we left her back on Terra, Horace said, as all of us peered over the railing of the airship's platform. Did any of you see Vela get off? Bowden asked, as the frown on his face grew deeper.
None of us did,
Shay said as she wrung her hands together.
Would she have really wandered out?
When was the last time you saw the girl?
Jenner asked. Not too long ago, Bowden said, and I was worried he would need a new cap by the time he was done twisting his apart. She wasn't feeling like herself again, and I suggested she go take a walk to clear her mind. I just hope she didn't interpret that as meaning a walk off the ship.
Should I go back?
Zoe asked from her place still at the wheel.
I can take us back if you need me to.
Let's think about this real quick, I said, before we did something like turn the whole kit and caboodle around. Bowden, given the state she's been in, do you really think Vela would have left to walk around a completely foreign place without you by her side? The raccoon man paused in his hat mangling to think about what I'd said, and after a moment I was relieved to see him take a small breath and return the wrinkled cap back to his head. No, you're right, Mr. Alex. There's no way she left the ship, he said with a decisive nod.
That means she's still on board, and it's just a matter of finding her, Jenner said. For now, I suggest Zoe and I stay here so we can find our heading for Aang while the rest of you confirm our headcount.
Sounds like a plan, I nodded.
Oh, and can somebody inform Arvid about the dinner plans? Jenner asked. We know the old boy needs a bit of a head start if we plan to eat at a decent time.
I'll track down the big guy, Horace said. And the rest of us will split up, I added. If any of you find her, try to coax her to the galley. With our various tasks at hand, we all separated so we could search the airship for the confused cockatoo woman. As I meandered up and down the airship's corridors, I let my mind wander. Now that I got a chance to really dwell on it, something about Velrala's behavior struck me as odd. Well, aside from the obvious, of course. I fingered the odd silver bell she demanded I carry with me at all times. At first, I had figured it was just some form of madness she'd succumbed to, so I didn't really take it too seriously. But ever since the night of the wedding when she insisted Zoe wear a particular flower in her hair, something began to niggle at me in its insistent niggling way. After the events of that night and a good night's sleep, certain things began to stand out to me with crystal clear clarity. But I was too preoccupied and heartsick to notice at the time. Now, the more I thought about the events leading up to the treacherous circus troupe, the more I realized how odd it was for someone to sneeze just close enough for me to actually hear it over the commotion in the large hall. Then, when I thought back a little farther than that, I remembered how agitated the cockatoo woman was before we all left. She'd somehow gotten it into her delusional head that Zoe would be safe as long as she kept the lucky flower in her hair all night. At the time, it just sounded like more of her strange madness talking. But the truth of the matter was, if it wasn't for that flower in Zoe's hair, would that person have sneezed? And if that person hadn't sneezed, would they have gotten away with it? Regardless, ever since then, I decided I would keep the bell she gave me on my person at all times, because I was almost 100% certain there would be a situation for me to test out my working theory once more. For now, I was only intent on finding her, because like I told her before, she was part of my crew no matter what. And aside from her strange behaviors, she was clearly suffering from something none of us really knew how to help her cope with. So the least I could do was track her down, make sure she wasn't hurt, and make sure she had some food. However, this was all easier said than done, because I'd forgotten a little about how this place was set up. I didn't know how, but there was a moment where it didn't matter which corridor I turned down, I always ended up back in the galley where I started. After the third time I wandered in and out of the lower four corridors, I had filled in a third of my mental map of this place, but still hadn't found Velrala. Even when I went to the second floor where the rest of the bedrooms were, she was nowhere to be found. I paused for a moment at the bottom of the third floor staircase and debated whether or not it would be a waste of time to check for her on the third floor, where pretty much the only thing up there was the family quarters. Ostensibly, she would have no reason to go up there aside from housekeeping. But these days her housekeeping duties were temporarily suspended due to her mental health. So really, I should just turn around and go back down the stairs. Instead, I followed that little voice in my gut that told me I was on the right track, even though logic would dictate otherwise. And I turned and walked up the stairs anyway. It would be best to be thorough rather than overlook something obvious. And I was glad I did so, because it didn't take me long to start hearing the sounds of a murmured conversation coming from the small study right at the top of the stairs. I made sure my footsteps were nearly silent, so I wouldn't startle either one of them in there, because over the top of Vella's alto, there was a pleasant burr I recognized as Ryland's tenor voice, as he chatted to her in a way that sounded deliberate yet polite. I tried to listen through the crack in the door, and I could only hear the tones of their voices, but both of them were in a better mental state than the last time I talked to them. I couldn't really make out any words, but it sounded as if Ryland would ask a question here and there, and after a moment he would receive a patient reply. It sounded so wholesome and normal, which was something these two people probably really needed at the moment, and I was almost sad to disrupt it. But I did say to check in with everybody else back in the galley, so maybe the two of them could continue their engaging chat while all of us waited for some of Arvid's delicious cooking. So before either of them could start up another small conversation, I opened the door with a little noise to announce my presence and make it seem like I hadn't been trying to eavesdrop for the past 10 minutes. They both stopped anyway and stared at me. So I made a keep-going gesture with my hands to let them know I wasn't in so much of a hurry that they couldn't finish their conversation. "Hey, you guys," I said, as I pulled up a chair next to Ryland. "Don't rush on my account, but I'm here to tell you there will be Arvid's awesome cooking later, so I hope you both are hungry."
"I'm not very hungry,"
Ryland admitted as he lowered his eyes to the table. Before I could reply to that, the cockatoo woman placed her hand on his shoulder until he looked up.
"Neither am I, but I do know I must eat, or else I will feel worse later on,"
she told him sagely.
"Now, come. What was your question?"
"So, what do you do when someone wants to sell your products for you?"
Ryland asked.
"Well, it's pretty easy. You just have to be good with numbers and find out how much you need to sell it to that person for."
Vella turned to another page in the book they were both looking at. I waited patiently while the cockatoo woman jumped back in to explain something about market value and trend buying or whatever. It sounded like a really boring econ class I used to have back in high school, and I vowed to myself I would never be an economist due to how utterly boring data analysis sounded. Although it was a well-known fact that Vell was a wizard when it came to selling things in the market, and as a good father I wanted to encourage lessons of all kinds for Ryland, not just the ones I could teach him, so I resigned myself to pretending to be engaged for his sake. And I had to admit, it was good to see Vella so lucid and at ease. Eventually they wrapped up their conversation, and Ryland earmarked the current page before he closed the book.
"I think I understand it better now," he said politely,
and the cockatoo woman smiled a genuine smile the likes of which I hadn't seen from her in quite some time.
"You're more than welcome to ask me questions any time,"
she said.
"And when you feel like you're ready to sell your idea, let me know, and I will help you demonstrate it for the people and take you to the stall lender who's cheapest."
The kid smiled wide again and leaned in to give the older woman a hug.
"Thanks, Auntie Vell,"
he said casually, and yet the effect it had on her face looked like she'd just been hit by a dump truck of unexpected feelings. I should know. The cherry on top was, of course, the fact that Ryland didn't think anything was out of the ordinary about bestowing such easy affection. And then he turned his attention to me.
"Hey, Dad, what's for dinner?"
he asked, and I was glad his appetite seemed to have returned.
It's a surprise, I think," I said, and smiled when his eyes got wide with pleasure.
"A surprise?"
he said, and now he sounded even more excited.
"I'm going to go wash up. But thanks again, Auntie.
Yes, you're welcome,
she said as she blushed faintly.
I'm glad I could help.
Then Rylan waved at the both of us before he turned on his heels and jaunted away. Don't worry, you'll get used to him, I chuckled when I glanced over at her shocked face.
Did he just adopt me as his aunt?
She asked with a confused look in her coal black eyes. I'm afraid that happens around him, I said as my grin grew wider. Horace says he's like a fungus. He grows on you.
That is quite an apt description for him,
she said, and she covered her lips to hide her smile. What were you guys talking about? I asked as I tipped my chair back on its legs.
He started asking me how to sell things for money in the market,
she explained as she stacked all of the books Rylan had no doubt pulled out on a whim and was too distracted to put back.
He thinks that once the Terrans figure out how to sell their screeches, there will be a need for this certain device he's named the Letter Hook.
And what, dare I ask, is a letter hook? I dared to ask, much to her amusement.
Apparently it's what the name suggests,
she said through another chuckle.
It is a metal device used to snag or hook a piece of correspondence away from the temperamental screeches without getting nipped in return. He is anticipating a problem and hoping to capitalize on a solution that will surely come about in the future once screecher mail becomes a thing.
That's actually pretty smart, holy shit, I remarked, and I was impressed in spite of myself.
Those were my thoughts exactly,
she said.
Well, almost. Hence why I decided to help him by answering a few questions. I always love a good entrepreneurial project.
We both chuckled at this and then lapsed into an easy silence. When I was alone with my thoughts once more, it hit me how strange it was that this woman and I were actually finally getting along. Whereas when we first met, I inadvertently became a target of her avarice and her idiotic husband. If someone would have told me one day we would be laughing and enjoying each other's company without any hidden agendas, I would have told them they were crazy. Seems I'd been wrong about a lot of those types of things lately. And maybe that was what was considered growing up. The ability to look beyond pettiness and first impressions. Oh, gross. Adulting. Thank you for helping him, by the way, I said as I smiled at her. Especially after last night. I think he really could use the distraction.
Ah, yes. I heard it was quite eventful,
she said as she shifted subtly in her seat. She was out of things to straighten and stack, so she made it a goal to arrange them by size instead, so she would have something to do with her hands. I noticed the small tell of her agitation and glanced up at her. Her eyes would no longer linger on mine for any significant amount of time, and she suddenly took on the air of nervousness for no discernible reason I could tell. So because I didn't have any concrete proof aside from what my gut was telling me, I could do nothing but come out and ask her directly. Why did you give Zoe that flower? I asked. It was a simple question, but the way she recoiled from it made it seem as if I'd smacked her across the face instead.
What do you mean?
She asked and clamped her hands together tightly. I want to know why you gave Zoe that flower before we left for the banquet. I stared at her with a neutral expression so she wouldn't feel intimidated. But I didn't think it mattered how I asked the question because it still made her upset.
It was just a trinket,
she said as she occupied herself by swirling patterns into the top of the table. Her actions were casual, but she couldn't hide the tremor in her voice.
Good luck charm, that's all.
I wanted to pry more out of her, but I stopped myself when I noticed the exhaustion still bruising her under her eyes and decided to put a pin in this conversation for later. Well, it was a good thing you did, because it ended up saving her life, I said, like I was letting it go, when in reality I was just going to have to pay more attention in the future.
I'm glad,
the cockatoo woman said with a sigh of relief, but I was almost certain the relief came from me dropping my line of questioning. Me too, I said, and stood up so I could offer my hand to her. Come on, I promised Bowden I would bring you to the galley if I ran across you.
Oh, Bodie,
she said in a fondly exasperated way.
He really does look out for me.
He cares about you just like we all do, I said, and then tucked her arm into my elbow. But it's true, he maybe cares for you a little bit more than the rest of us. She stopped suddenly in the middle of the hall, and I slowed with her so I could give her a questioning look.
"You all really do care for me, don't you?"
she asked, and her gaze went in and out of focus in a way that wasn't normal. I decided the best course of action was to maintain course, so I patted her on the hand and nodded. "Of course we do. I told you, you are officially a part of this crew. And if you don't believe me, ask your new nephew." This attempt at humor effectively made her laugh and forget about whatever darkness she was thinking of a moment ago.
"Oh, he didn't really give me a choice, did he?"
she chuckled as we continued to stroll toward the staircase. "He doesn't give anybody a choice," I laughed back. "We just have to deal with it as far as he's concerned."
"It makes me sorry that I ever could have treated him so poorly in the past,"
she mused as her steps slowed once more.
"But I hope you do see things are different now. And I know I haven't been myself, but everything I do is for this family. I hope you know that's why I might say or do things that are..."
"You don't have to explain it until you want to," I said when her words trailed off into nothing. Part of me suddenly felt bad for prying earlier, because it was clear she didn't even know why she did some of the things she did. So asking her about it probably just frustrated her or made her feel more ashamed.
"Thank you, Alex. You are too kind to the likes of me,"
she said, and the way her gaze drifted off once more told me I probably wouldn't be able to get her back for some time. As it was, Rylan had gone and told everyone Vella was okay and on her way down, so it saved me from having to round everyone up just to assure them we weren't missing anyone back on Terror.
"Vella, darling, where were you?"
the raccoon man asked as he approached us and took over for me.
"Oh, Bodhi,"
Velrala sighed and allowed him to seat her at the table tucked close under his arm.
"Really quite glad we didn't leave you behind, Miss Velly," Horace said as he handed her a cup of tea.
"As if you could,"
she replied without missing a beat. And it was so out of character, the wide-eyed look on Horace's face made all of us crack up.
"Well said,"
Shay giggled, just as Arvid placed a big covered platter in the center of the table. It wasn't even uncovered yet, but I could smell the mouth-watering aroma even now.
"Avi, you've gone above and beyond,"
Mr. Jenner said, as he helped bring three massive bowlfuls to the table, filled with steaming sides of mashed things, buttered root veggie things, and something that looked like corn on the cob, but it was bright pink.
"What is all of this?"
Zoe asked as her ears perked straight up.
"It all smells really good."
"Hey, I'll recognize this,"
Rylan said when he pulled out one of the pink corns.
"Is this that stuff you called, Oru?
"Oriol,"
the sloth man droned and set down another covered platter, followed by a basket of something that looked like fluffy cloud bread.
"Yeah, Oreo,"
Rylan said as he eyed the bread next.
"And is that Romtos?"
"Now that you mention it, those do sound familiar,"
Velrala mused, and she picked up a bready pillow so she could examine it.
"I vaguely remember signing a purchase order with those words on it."
"That was me helping Arvid get provisions,"
the kid explained, and then dipped his finger in the lime green mashed stuff.
"Hmm, what's this, Arvi?"
"Moo-goo,"
the chef answered as he lifted the lid off the platter in the middle, and all of us admired the roasted, trussed-up, golden-brown, turkey-like creature with four wings.
"Verd."
"The verd is the word," I muttered under my breath before I reached for a large drumstick and put it on my plate.
"It seems as if you cooked up a little of something from all over the isles,"
Jenner observed, as he uncovered the last platter, which held various fondue bowls of broth and cheese that I recognized as having before. I thought it was a lemmick, if I wasn't mistaken.
"The moogoo is Omish,"
Jenner said as he pointed to the green stuff Rylan was heaping on his plate.
"And if there is any left, you will all be treated to a sumptuous dish indeed."
"Ahem." Horace nudged the voracious teenager as he attempted to scoop another spoonful on his plate. Rylan stopped with the spoon hovering over the bowl, saw how we were all looking at him, and then lowered the portion back down.
Sorry, he said with a blush. It's really good.
All of us laughed, and Horace roughly scrubbed a hand through the kid's sandy hair.
Where is the verd from?
Zoe asked after she swallowed a morsel.
Verd is an Ang folk staple,
the koala man answered as he piled on a few verd wings and then reached for a little clay pot I hadn't seen earlier.
It is best with this delicious sauce made from a mumbu fruit.
I reached for the sauce jar when Jenner handed it to me, and I put a little of the fruity glaze on my monster of a meat leg. When I bit into the salty, crispy skin, the tart and tangy sauce contrasted nicely, and it tasted Hawaiian in origin, like pineapple-glazed pulled pork.
Oh, wow, that's awesome, I said through a juicy mouthful.
I really love this romtos bread dipped in this spiced broth,
Shay enthused, and then because she was next to me, she gave me a sample. The airy texture was chewy and delightful, and the broth was savory and rich, almost like a gravy. But when that happy green shit called mugu came around, I understood why Rylan wanted to eat all of it, because it tasted like the best creamy garlic mashed potatoes I'd ever had. It was honestly the best meal all of us had eaten since we left Nada. And as far as lifting our spirits, it helped immensely. We all dug into this home-cooked feast Arvid had prepared, and eventually the conversation ebbed and flowed through various topics. And the best part was, none of them were serious. It was all light-hearted banter, easy laughs, and good wine. By the time the meal was over, we were all in high spirits and a bit dozy from being so full. So all of us decided to turn in for the night, except for Jenner and Bowden, who would take turns in the wheelhouse. Eventually, we would have to come up with a system so we could alternate, but for now, I was grateful they had it well in hand. The pleasant haze creeping into my mind told me I was going to sleep soundly. And I was proven right, because barely a second after I snuggled under the duvet between Zoe and Shay, I was swallowed whole by darkness. I sank rapidly without that carousel of colors, or any dreams of consequence. But that eerie scream reverberated within my skull. The dreamscape I found myself in was still blacker than pitch, but that painful voice crying out into the lonely darkness had me seeking something I couldn't see. Then I suddenly snapped awake and had a miniature heart attack because I was somehow on the second floor balcony. I was disoriented, and the air chilled me to the bone as the airship drifted through the mist. I had absolutely no idea how I'd gotten out here because sleepwalking wasn't something I'd ever had a problem with. That little quirk was reserved for Rylan, who just so happened to be sleepwalking on the balcony as well. Only instead of being on the solid tiles on the ground like I was, he was teetering precariously on the balcony's ledge.